When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 5, Part 1 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Surrender of Milazzo Castle. The Check at the Straits. Diplomats and Politicians. Garibaldi è una grande puissance morale. Il exerce un immenso prestige non solamente in Italia ma surtout in Europe. Si demain j'entra in lutte avec Garibaldi, il est probable que j'usesse pour moi la majorité des vecs diplomates. Mais l'opinion publique européenne sera contre moi. Et l'opinion publique aurait raison, car Garibaldi a rendu l'Italie le plus grand service qu'un homme puisse lui rendre. Il donna à l'Italien confiance en eux-mêmes. Il prouva à l'Europe que les Italiens savent se battre et mourir sur le champ des batailles pour reconquérir une patrie. Cela n'empêche pas qu'elle ne soit énormément désirable que la révolution de Naples s'accomplisse sans lui. Cabour to an intimate friend, August 9, 1860. The castle of Milazzo, which Garibaldi had yet to take, rose between the two seas on a granite precipice more than 300 feet high. Founded by the Saracens, improved by the Normans and Angevin, it had been finally enlarged and beautified by the Emperor Charles V. A place of importance throughout the Middle Ages, it had in the War of the Vespers been occupied by the Sicilians and French in turn. In 1675 it had successfully sustained a regular siege, and in the wars of the early 18th century and again in the struggle with Napoleon, it had been occupied by the British and their allies. The English cavalry barracks of 50 years back could be seen on the shore below. When Bosco held it against Garibaldi, it was, as it still is today, a spacious and pleasant place. Unlike some of the featureless castle prisons of the Neapolitan mainland, of which the very style of architecture seems to symbolize cruelty and crime. Below the fine medieval keep lay grass plateaus a quarter of a mile broad and long, enclosed by the outer works of Charles V. Hence the defenders could view the Calabrian coast, the Lipari Islands, and the eternal smoke of Stromboli. The Gulf of Milazzo, where Duilius with his grappling irons destroyed the fleets of Carthage and made Rome mistress even of the sea. The plain where Garibaldi had just triumphed in conflict man against man, the bare mountain ridges stretching away towards the hidden Messina, and near at hand a profusion of cactus, fig trees, and shrubs clinging to the precipices of the castle rock. In the silent midday heat, the stronghold gives the impression, not of decay, but of long, unbroken peace. Its defences, if antiquated, were in good repair, and could only be breached by a siege cannon, which Garibaldi did not possess. To defend such a place against irregular troops would have been an easy and even pleasant task, if Bosco had taken care to lay in provisions while his communications were still open. But there was little food, and that bad. The water stank, and the dirty habits of more than 4,000 soldiers, who would not even take the trouble to bury the corpses of man or beast, soon rendered the whole of that large area unsanitary. The royalists had fought well in battle, but defeat had destroyed their discipline. and when they were put on half rations, they muttered threats about opening the gate. At the first sound of mutiny, the fighting colonel himself lost his nerve and began signaling to Messina the tale of his distress in messages on the semaphore which Garibaldi and his officers read with delight. He enlarged on the state of the provisions and water. He complained that the enemy had, in the last 24 hours, shot one man dead on the ramparts, besides wounding 8 men and 3 mules. He declared that a breach for a storming party could be made in a few days. The latter proposition was undeniable as a piece of abstract military theory, for the Windmill Hill, whence the Garibaldini were sniping, was only 500 yards away, and was on a level with the lower parts of the castle. But the practical inference was nil, because the assailants had no breaching cannon, and the fortress was defended by 40 pieces. The morale of the troops, so ended Bosco's tale of woe, is destroyed. And so, he might have added, was that of their commander, who could no longer distinguish between real danger of starvation and imaginary dangers of storm and battery. On July 21st, Marshal Clay held a council of war at Messina. His subordinates hated him and one another, and the prevailing sentiment at the council was each man's desire to throw upon his neighbor the responsibility for disasters present and to come. The sense of the council of war appears to have been that they were bound in honor to march at once to relieve Bosco, but that there were not enough horses and carts for the transport service, and that a column of Garibaldini advancing northwards from Catania would step into Messina if any part of its garrison of 15,000 were rashly sent to Milazzo. This fear was somewhat out of place, since Eber's column at Catania as yet barely numbered 1,000 men, and only 200 or 300 had been sent as far north as Taormina. But this trivial reconnaissance, as Clary's own dispatches show, seriously affected his decision not to move to the help of Bosco. Once indeed, on July 22nd, Clary ordered 3 regiments to embark and signaled to Bosco that they had already sailed to his relief. But in a few hours he countermanded the movement, either from fear of the Garibaldini at Taormina, or else in obedience to orders from the war minister, Pianell. When the first news reached Naples that Bosco's force was shut up in Milazzo, Pianell, much as he wished to suspend all hostilities, felt that he must extricate the rash colonel before resuming the defensive. He therefore ordered a large expedition to be put on board the fleet in the Bay of Naples to sail to the relief of Milazzo. But the fleet, more liberal in political sentiment than the army, refused to take the troops on board, and the mutiny was encouraged by the admiral, Count d'Aquila, the king's uncle. The case was brought up for discussion before the ministers, into whose willing ears d'Aquila poured such effective arguments against a resumption of hostilities in Sicily that they decided to send, instead of a relieving fleet and army, empty transports to fetch away Bosco and his men. Following the transports, they dispatched a large part of the fleet, with a Colonel Anzani on board, whose instructions from Pianell were to negotiate the capitulation both of Milazzo and of the garrison of Messina. But Clary, as soon as he was assured that the ministry did not require him to relieve Milazzo, again assumed the part of a grieved hero and refused to evacuate Messina on any account. On July 23rd, the approach of the Neapolitan war vessels to the port of Milazzo caused some anxiety among the volunteers. If the town were bombarded from the sea, it would be necessary for them to retire and to lose the fruits of the victory which they had so dearly bought. Garibaldi, as usual, showed a bold face and fitted up a battery on the mole with cannon landed off the Tucuri. The newcomers, however, proved to be intent on more charitable thoughts. Colonel Lanzani and the dictator soon signed a treaty of capitulation by which the troops in the castle were to march out with their arms and half the battery mules, the cannon and ammunition of the castle, the rest of the mules and all the horses were to be left behind for the conquerors. Bosco had boasted that he would enter Palermo on Medici's horse, so Garibaldi had determined that Medici should enter Messina on Bosco's horse, as shortly afterwards took place. On the morning of July 25th, When the Bourbon troops were to march out of the castle, the Piedmontese fleet appeared in the offing. Admiral Persano, seeing Neapolitan warships lying off Milazzo, ordered his decks to be cleared for action, presumably intending to save Garibaldi from bombardment even at the cost of a rupture with Naples. When he found how peacefully matters had been settled, he contented himself with embracing the dictator and congratulating him in the name of Victor Emmanuel on his fresh victory for the common cause. The Bourbon troops filed down to the point of embarkation with the honors of war between two lines of ragged volunteers. Although they had full opportunity to desert, they were loudly invited to fraternize and to join the army of true Italians. Few except among the artillery answered the appeal. At the tail of the column walked Bosco, guarded as a prisoner, fuming and pulling at his mustache. He was hissed by the townspeople, who were beginning to return to their houses from their hiding places in the peninsula. It was an unpleasant scene, and moved the Garibaldini to sympathize for Bosco, in spite of his hectoring manner, which did not desert him in this dramatic exit from before the footlights of history. It soon became known why Garibaldi had caused Bosco to be placed under arrest during the embarkation. When paired with a few of his fellow countrymen and others went to take possession of the abandoned castle, they found the mules which had been surrendered under the capitulation lying about dead on the turf, and many of the guns spiked. They luckily detected, before they had trodden upon it, a train of gunpowder hidden under straw, thickly strewn with detonators and running under the door of a magazine, which was intended to blow the citadel and its new occupants sky high. When Garibaldi, accompanied by Admiral Persano and the Marios, came up to the castle, they found Bosco's horses, abandoned and frightened, running round and round the grass plateau of the outer enclosure. The dictator took his lasso and amused himself and his companions by a display of the skill which he had acquired in South America more than 20 years before. Alberto Mario and his English wife Jessie had arrived from Palermo in pursuit of the army. They found a number of truants from their Garibaldi foundling hospital enlisted in Dunne's ranks, half a dozen of them badly wounded. Although they had run away from the Institute, they had not run away from the rifles of the Cacciatori. One little wounded Sicilian apologized to Mario, stroking his hand as he said, "Are you angry with us, Signor Comandante? So many of our brigade are wounded and killed. Milordo, the colonel, says that after the Battle of Milazzo, no one can say again that the Sicilians never fight." Another boy of 12 suffered amputation sitting in the lap of Jesse Mario, who said that she cried more than he did. These young scamps off the streets of Palermo were not the only class who behaved admirably in the hospital. Throughout the campaign, in the ill-equipped ambulances, without chloroform or proper dressings, the silent endurance of pain by Italians of sensitive and cultivated natures aroused the admiration of British military men. The terrible and partly unnecessary sufferings to which the patriots were exposed by the absence of proper provision never moved them to indignation or even to complaint. They would bear anything for Italy and for the general. In Milazzo, where lay half the men wounded in the recent battle, there was no straw to fill the bed ticks which the Marios had brought from Palermo. At Barcelona, which took in the remaining 300, the inhabitants were more active and things went better. Both here and later on at Naples and Caserta, that excellent creature of the Lord, Jessie White Mario, as one of her patients called her, did her best to be the Florence Nightingale of the campaign, though she had no staff of trained nurses. Fanatical in her republicanism, lacking in toleration and in charm of manner, she had the Spartan virtues of her creed and a power of complete self-sacrifice, which she had learnt, perhaps, from her friend and master, Mazzini. She was equally the friend of Garibaldi, who knew well how much he owed to Jessie, and how many of his best followers were saved by her ceaseless exertions. Superficially, at least, there was little in common between this lady of fixed and fiery faith and the comfortable citizens of her native land. But they were too ready to praise her when they heard how she had attended the wretched pallets of hundreds of wounded Italians, who blessed her in their pain and her country for her sake. Desiring to take advantage of the enthusiasm for his cause prevailing in England, Garibaldi, while still quartered in the castle of Milazzo, consulted his British companions in arms, who had borne themselves so well in the battle, as to the possibility of raising more of their compatriots to come out and join him on the Neapolitan mainland. The idea was suggested to him by Hugh Forbes, a gentleman who, wearing a white top hat, had shared the perils of his retreat from Rome to the Adriatic in 1849. In the interval between the two Italian revolutions, Forbes had been in the United States, where he had had some peculiar dealings with old John Brown previous to the Virginia raid. He now appeared at Milazzo. Garibaldi fell in love with Forbes' proposal that a British legion should be raised, but refused to give him the command and left him behind as governor of Milazzo Castle. The scheme aroused little enthusiasm among those who would have been best qualified to carry it out. Mr. Dalmage, who was a British officer on leave from Malta, refused to touch it, and Dunne himself, who had quarrelled with his countrymen when he left the Queen's service, angrily declared that he did not want any more of them out there. He prophesied that a whole regiment raised at a few days' notice among a civilian population and shipped to a strange land would contain good elements, but that for discipline reasons it would be more trouble than it was worth during the short period that the war was likely to last. But Garibaldi, though he knew that the British Legion would not come in time to be of much assistance in the Neapolitan kingdom, looked forward to a campaign in the Papal States and to the capture of Rome. He therefore sent to England as an agent for the raising of the Legion a certain Stiles, who had behaved well in the Battle of Milazzo, but turned out no better than he should be, and soon fell out with the disinterested committee who took up the project in London. It was now evident that there would be no further fighting in Sicily. Since Marshal Clay and his 15,000 at Messina had not moved to the relief of Milazzo, they certainly would not take the field on their own account now that it had fallen. Garibaldi's way lay open down to the shore of the Straits. Medici, duly mounted on Bosco's horse, led the vanguard into the streets of Messina, and on July 28th he signed a treaty with Clary, by which the citadel was to be held by the royalist garrison and the town by the Garibaldini. Hostilities between them were to be suspended by sea as by land, so that the citadel, which completely dominated the entrance of the harbour, might not fire a shot at the dictator's vessels, even when they sailed out under the muzzles of the king's cannon to invade his Calabrian provinces. Such a treaty, extorted without bloodshed from 15,000 men in an impregnable fortress, was a great advantage for the inferior forces of the volunteers, who would have had much difficulty in entering the streets of Messina if Clary had resisted their approach on the mountain ridges above the town and in the forts designed for its protection. Nor could they have remained in Messina if the citadel had been free to open fire. The terms of this treaty are a measure of the panic struck into the heart of the royalist troops by the defeat of Bosco, and a measure also of the ardor with which the Neapolitan ministers desired to avoid further fighting in the island. The greater part of the garrison were now withdrawn from the citadel of Messina to the mainland. During the anxious month that followed the Battle of Milazzo, the politics of Europe turned on the question whether Garibaldi could succeed in crossing the straits. Would the naval powers interfere to prevent him? And even if they did not, could he cross in the face of the Neapolitan army and fleet? The diplomatic part of the question was destined to be settled in a few days by the secret activities of Cavour. He was now fully determined to acquire the Neapolitan kingdom for Victor Emmanuel, if possible without, but if necessary, with further aid from Garibaldi. On July 14th, he had still believed that he would be able, before Garibaldi could leave Sicily, to engineer a revolution in Naples by means of the agents whom he had sent there, at the critical moment the Piedmontese fleet was to appear in the bay. Sanguine of success, he had written to Admiral Persano, "We must at all costs, on the one hand, prevent Garibaldi from crossing the straits, and on the other excite a revolution in Naples. If this were to succeed, the government of Victor Emmanuel would at once be proclaimed there. In that case, you would immediately sail with your whole squadron for Naples. The plan presupposed some active disloyalty in the army and some power of initiative in the inhabitants of Naples. Neither were forthcoming. A week after he had written this letter to Persano, Cavour had become so far doubtful of his ability to provoke an internal revolution that he decided to clear the way for Garibaldi's passage of the Straits. His earnest wish to forestall the dictator at Naples no longer blinded him to the fact that the advance of the Red Shirts might prove, after all, the only means of disposing of the House of Bourbon. He continued, indeed, until after the middle of August, to work and hope for a wholesale desertion of the Neapolitan army to the national cause, which would remove the need for Garibaldi to cross the Straits, and would place all authority at both ends of the peninsula in the hands of the ministry at Turin, but meanwhile, not allowing himself to be duped by these golden hopes, Cavour entered into a conspiracy with Victor Emmanuel to open Garibaldi's way before him, in spite of the threats of European diplomacy, to which it was necessary all the while to appear subservient. The king and his minister, while publicly requesting the dictator to halt, secretly urged him to advance. And while not daring to dispute, through regular diplomatic channels, the proposition that he ought to be stopped at the Straits, they dissolved by a hint to England the concert of naval powers that was being formed for that purpose. These two pieces of secret service, Count Leita's mission to Garibaldi and Sir James Laquita's mission to Lord John Russell, have only recently been established as certain historical facts. Their importance in the history of the crisis that made Italy is very great. At 4 o'clock on the evening of July 22nd, Count Leita Modigliani came by appointment to the palace at Turin to receive from the king's hands a written message which he was to take to Garibaldi. Victor Emmanuel first gave him a letter requesting the dictator not to cross the Straits, the ostensible royal message published to the world to allay the threatenings of France. "But here," said the king to Count Leita, "is a second note which you will at once administer to Garibaldi to neutralize the effect of the first." So saying, Victor Emmanuel handed over a letter containing the following words in his own handwriting: "Now, having written as King, Victor Emmanuel suggests to you to reply in this sense, which I know is what you feel. Reply that you are full of devotion and reverence for your king, that you would like to obey his counsels, but that your duty to Italy forbids you to promise not to help the Neapolitans when they appeal to you to free them from a government which true men and good Italians cannot trust, that you cannot therefore obey the wishes of the king, but must reserve full freedom of action." With these two missives in his pocket, Count Leita left the royal presence. The same day he saw Cavour and Farini, who chafed him on the Garibaldian part he was about to play. He sailed to Palermo and thence to Milazzo, where he arrived on the morning of July 27th, just in time to catch Garibaldi before he started to overtake Medici and the vanguard at Messina. As soon as they were closeted together, the king's messenger produced the two letters in their order. At the second, delivered by Leita, with sly excuses for the first, Garibaldi burst out laughing. He rose at once and went into his bedroom, where Sertori and Trecci and others were talking so loudly that he was forced to say, "Gentlemen, I have got to write a letter. Please don't make so much noise." So saying, he sat down and wrote his answer to the king, which thrilled the heart of Italy in the ensuing weeks. "Sire," he wrote, "Your Majesty knows the high esteem and love I bear you. But the present state of things in Italy does not allow me to obey you, as I should have wished. Called by the peoples, I refrained as long as I could. But if now, in spite of all the calls that reach me, I were longer to delay, I should fail my duty and imperil the sacred cause of Italy. Allow me then, sire, this time to disobey you. As soon as I shall have fulfilled what I have undertaken, by freeing the peoples from a hated yoke, I will lay down my sword at your feet and obey you for the rest of my life." Lita hastened back to Turin, the public bearer of his famous reply. But the world knew nothing of the other document which he safely carried back, the king's original draft, of which the dictator's answer was but a paraphrase adorned with a few Garibaldian touches. That most compromising of documents has just come to light after a discreet interval of 50 years. It was easy thus, while saving appearances, to make sure that Garibaldi would obey the law of his being and go forward as fast and as far as he was able. But to prevent the maritime powers from stopping him at the straits was a harder task. For the moment, little was to be feared from Austria, alienated as she was from the government of Naples by the nature of its appeal to England, France, and Piedmont. The diplomatic representatives of Naples did not hesitate to allege that if the Western powers would force a 6 months' truce upon Garibaldi, their country would be able to hold the elections to her new parliament and would lend her regular army as soon as it was required for the inevitable war against Austria in Venice. Though such promises were only the result of abject fear and were unlikely to be fulfilled, they caused irritation, if not alarm, at Vienna, and postponed the season of Austrian intervention. Napoleon, on the other hand, at that moment desired to preserve the Bourbon dynasty on the mainland as a constitutional state under French direction far more ardently than he desired a month later to preserve the Pope's Adriatic dominions. He was therefore most anxious to stop Garibaldi at the Straits, but he was no less anxious to preserve good relations with England. Both these objects could be achieved by a naval combination of France and England to hold the Straits of Messina against the passage of Garibaldini, and this was proposed by the French ministers to Palmerston and Russell. Lord John, in his English simplicity, supposed that Victor Emmanuel and Cavour meant what they said when they declared against Garibaldi's invasion of Calabria, and no doubt felt that he could best serve Italy by acting in accordance with the publicly expressed wishes of Cavour. The British ministers, therefore, were not indisposed to listen to the arguments of Napoleon when he proposed that England and France should send the two greatest fleets in the world to protect the Calabrian coast against the Red Shirts. Details as to the number of ships to be employed were actually arranged at Naples between King Francis' ministers, Brenet, and the French admiral. The final consent of the British cabinet had yet to be received, but if Palmerston and Russell fathered the scheme, it would meet with no resistance from their colleagues, who, except Gladstone, were less enthusiastic than they in the Italian cause. It was a moment full of danger, but Cavour was warned just in time of the blow which the extreme subtleness of his policy was preparing for him in the house of his friends. The warning came, it is said, through an indiscretion of one of his worst enemies. The story goes that the French Empress, in conversation with Nigra, the Piedmontese representative of Paris, let drop a hint of the negotiations with England, that Nigra extracted the whole truth from her by pretending to sympathize with the project and sent the news on to Turin. Cavour, greatly alarmed, went straight to the British legation and asked Hudson point blank how to prevent Russell from being made an unconscious agent in the ruin of Italy's best hopes. Hudson, happily inspired, advised Cavour to send Sir James Lacaita, the intimate friend of the Russell family, to explain the real situation to Lord John. Giacomo Lacaita, a gentleman of Apulia and a lawyer of Naples, had in 1850 been Mr. Gladstone's political mentor during his famous visit. Driven into exile for this, he became naturalized in England and was knighted as Sir James Lacaita for public services rendered to his adopted country. In July 1860, he was engaged in examining the candidates for our Indian civil service. On the 23rd, the rain of an English summer's day gave him a severe cold, and to further his distress, as he noted in his diary, he heard that a special Neapolitan envoy, Le Marquis de Grecia, had arrived in London and had been closeted with Lord John. On the next day, Tuesday, July 24th, he spent another chilly morning examining the young men, viva voce, came home exceedingly ill, and took to his bed. He was called up by an unexpected visit from Emmanuel D'Azeglio, the Piedmontese minister in England, who, in obedience to Cavour's message, came to request La Caeta to go at once to Lord John and put him on his guard against an application he would receive for intervention to force an armistice on Sicily. In spite of his illness, La Caeta dressed again and disregarded the protests of his family, dragged himself into the streets to obey the orders of Cavour, and as it chanced to bring about the making of Italy. Arriving at the Russell's townhouse, he rang the bell. The servant who appeared knew him well as a friend of the family. The conversation that followed was to this effect. "Is Lord John at home?"
"Not at home, Sir James."
"Is he out or only busy?"
"He's engaged, most particular, Sir James, with the French ambassador. I have turned away the Turkish ambassador, and I have strict orders to let in no one except the minister for Naples."
"There's no time to lose," thought La Caeta, and then inquired, "Is Lady John at home then?"
"She's in bed, Sir James, ill."
Then La Caeta took out a card and wrote upon it, "For the love you bear the memory of your father, see me this instant," and sent up this strange message to the lady of the house. In a few minutes he was by her bedside. He persuaded her to send down to her husband the simple message, "Come up at once." Thinking to find his wife suddenly taken worse, Lord John left Persini, the French ambassador, sitting there, rushed upstairs, opened the door of the bedroom, and found himself face to face with La Caeta. It was no time for apologies or explanations. In a flood of impassioned words, the Apulian poured forth his soul to his English friend. Was 1848 to be repeated? Then Sicily had revolted, then England and France had helped to prevent the Sicilians from invading Naples, and then Sicily had been reconquered. If Garibaldi crossed now, Italy would be made. If he was stopped, division, reaction, and disaster would ensue as before. Did Lord John wish to be forever loved or forever hated by liberal Europe? A violent paroxysm of coughing shortened his eloquence. But he had said enough to show Lord John what Cavour wanted England to do. "Go to bed," he said to La Caeta, "and don't be so sure that I'm going to sign that treaty yet." Russell's mind was well prepared for these ideas, for during the summer his wife had received letters from her Neapolitan friend Poerio, urging that the Bourbon must be dethroned and Italy made now or never. And for a fortnight past Hudson and Elliot themselves, new converts, had been preaching the doctrine of complete Italian unity in their private letters to the foreign minister. Going downstairs, Lord John presumably put off Persini with what excuse he could, for 2 hours later he sent round a messenger to La Caeta to tell him to be of good cheer. And at the cabinet, held on the afternoon of July 25th, it was decided to reject the French proposal with regard to coercing Garibaldi. Persini was amazed at the volte-face of the British ministers, for, as he himself tells us, he had obtained Lord Palmerston's promise to join in stopping Garibaldi. On July 26, Lord John wrote to our ambassador of Paris a dispatch suitable for publication, no reader of which would ever guess that the majestic current of British foreign policy had just been deflected from its course by one of the civil service examiners. "I informed Monsieur de Persini," writes Russell, "that Her Majesty's government were of the opinion that no case had been made out for the departure on their part from their general principle of non-intervention." Her Majesty's government had only come to this conclusion within the last 48 hours. "That the force of Garibaldi was not in itself sufficient to overthrow the Neapolitan monarchy. If the navy, army, and people of Naples were attached to the king, Garibaldi would be defeated. If, on the contrary, they were disposed to welcome Garibaldi, our interference would be an intervention in the internal affairs of the Neapolitan kingdom." This was sound doctrine. To come to the point, "If France chose to interfere alone, we should merely disapprove her course and protest against it. In our opinion, the Neapolitans ought to be masters either to reject or to receive Garibaldi." Napoleon was not prepared to take a course against which England would protest,
and the project of foreign intervention fell dead. Garibaldi had no longer anything to fear from the French and British fleets, but he still had before him a military operation of immense difficulty to cross the Straits of Messina through the midst of the Neapolitan fleet and to land on the Calabrian coast in the face of the Neapolitan army. The modern Odysseus stood on the sandy cape of Charybdis and, gazing across at Scia's now castled rock, bethought him of his many devices. Other heroes had striven in vain to become masters of this event. Half a century before, the generals of the great Napoleon, including Murat himself, had been baffled by this same strip of sea, 2 miles wide at the narrowest point, which had guarded Sicily from the French as safely as 21 miles of Northern Ocean had guarded from them a more favored island. End of chapter 5, part 1. Chapter 5, part 2 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Surrender of Milazzo Castle. The lighthouse, which gives its name of Faro to the Cape of Charybdis, and an old fort and battery by its side, stand at the end of the spit of sand where the north and east sides of the triangle of Sicily unite. On the sand dunes behind the lighthouse, the greater part of the Garibaldian army was bivouacked during the first 3 weeks of August. The depth of the water round the cape, which enables the tunny fishers to row their boats within a few yards of the pebbly shore, made it an excellent place for a great embarkation. 2 saltwater lakes, near at hand, gave safe harborage to the larger transports and to rafts which were being constructed to take across horses and cannon, while the flotilla of small boats which Garibaldi collected from Messina and the neighboring fishing villages were drawn up along the beach of the sea. The mean houses of Faro village afforded useful shelter. It was on these sands that the British had been encamped 50 years before, and the remains of their trenches could still be seen. Garibaldi had 3 new earthwork batteries erected, where he mounted some indifferent cannon taken off his only warship, the Torquay, and from the castle of Milazzo. With these and the 3 small cannon in the fort beside the lighthouse, he made pretense to command the Sicilian side of the narrow waters. On the roasting sand, between the lighthouse and the lakes, the volunteers lay encamped day after day, amid scenes of nature and of man very different from the rainy streets of London and the dim rooms of Chesham Place, where their fate had just been decided. The crowded quarters soon became insanitary. The food and water were insufficient. On the open sands, the sea mist soaked them by night, and the sun scorched them by day, and there was little to relieve body or soul, except constant bathing in the sea, drilling, and guessing how the general meant to carry them across. Among Garibaldi's own retinue, the gaiety of the days in Palermo Palace and Milazzo Castle had given place to a more serious mood. Their chief was silent for hours together, passing about between Messina and the Faro, sometimes mounting the lighthouse to watch the coming and going of the Bourbon ships, sometimes vanishing no one knew whither, concealing even from Medici the plans that engrossed him all day long, but keeping his telescope ever directed on the Calabrian shore. The eyes and thoughts of all men were fixed on the coast opposite, so near and yet so far, the ground whence one could march to Naples, to Rome, to Venice. The toe of Italy has for its bone the enormous granite mass of Aspromonte, the rugged mountain, of which the plateaus and spurs, clothed in forests of oak, pine, and chestnut, and cut by deep canyons, each paved with a dry fumara of stones washed white by flood, run down to the shores upon which the Garibaldini were so covetously gazing. Where the last steep precipices of Aspromonte overhang the Mediterranean, the road crawls beneath them along the narrow strip of shore, joining the crowded villages of Vagnara, Favazzini, Celia, and Canitello. Along the road, the red shirts could watch the enemy's columns moving to and fro. The narrowest point of the straits was commanded from the Calabrian side by two small forts of Torricavallo and Antifumara, built on the hillside about 100 yards above the road and the sea. If Garibaldi could capture one of these forts, his guns would command the narrowest part of the straits from side to side, for he would then have batteries on both shores. The Neapolitan fleet would therefore be compelled to stand out of the narrows, and he could pass his army across from the Ferro to the captured fort. It was on this basis that he planned his first attempt. On the night of August 3rd, a forlorn hope of 200 men, picked out to capture the fort of Altifumara, embarked in rowboats at the Ferro. Garibaldi himself, always to the fore in any maritime operation, arranged and guided the flotilla to mid-channel. He then returned to the Sicilian shore, where the rest of the army was embarking in steamers and fishing boats, ready to cross at dawn if a signal from the opposite shore announced the success of the enterprise. Meanwhile, the 200, under cover of a cloudy night, rowed through the middle of the Neapolitan cruisers and landed not far from the desired place. Their leader, Musolino, a Calabrian, had visited his native soil in disguise a few days before, and had arranged, as he believed, that the gates of the fort should be opened from the inside. But the alarm was given, their night attack was repulsed, and they had no course left but to escape into the mountains of the interior. At first they ascended the Fumara that debouches beside the fort, guided through the night by the glint of its white stones. Later on they climbed the mountain walls in complete darkness, dragging each other up the steepest places by the muzzles of their guns. During the next 10 days, these 200 men were the only invaders on Neapolitan soil. They wandered about the upper plains of Aspromonte at a height of over 3,000 feet above the sea, suffering from intense cold by night and August sun by day, sometimes starving in the mountain desert, sometimes falling in with trains of mules bearing ample provisions sent up for them from the Liberal Committee of Reggio. Owing to the fact that the new intendant of Reggio appointed Dan Liborio Romano was a constitutionalist in tacit sympathy with the invaders, this rebel committee acted with singular publicity, in spite of the presence of the royal troops in town. The oldest royalist militia, the Guardie Urbane, had just been disarmed by an order of Don Liborio from Naples, and the new National Guard, liberals to a man, had been armed in their stead. The civil and local authorities, therefore, no longer gave any support to the regular army camped in their midst. The pitiful numbers of the invading force in Aspromonte were increased by small bands of Calabrian peasants, hardy mountaineers in goatskin sandals, knee-breeches, shirt-sleeves, and brimless sugar-loaf hats ornamented with streamers of black velvet. The romantic Calabrian costume, which the opera house and the picture gallery of that era had made as familiar to cultured Europe as the kilt of Sir Walter Scott's Highlanders. Their leader was Plutino, a local magnate jealous of the fame which his fellow Calabrian Musolino had acquired in the province as leader of this expedition. Both Musolino and Plutino were feudal chiefs and political leaders, rather than expert military men, and the command of the expedition was made over by consent to Missori, the Lombard who had saved Garibaldi's life at Milazzo. Under his spirited leadership, these few hundred men kept the Neapolitan army perpetually on the Che Vive. Every night they lighted a blaze of bonfires along the heights to show their friends on the Sicilian shore that the insurrection was alive in Calabria. Once they came right down to the coast, captured Bagnara, and held it until driven out by several thousand troops. The Calabrians behaved well in this first skirmish. In the mountain hamlets like Solano and Petavalle, the invaders learnt something of Calabrian local politics. The blood feuds, which under the form of liberal and Bourbon faction fights, had devastated the villages in 48. Since that year the course of events had so far alienated or discouraged the royalist party, that Missouri's men were almost everywhere assisted and were nowhere opposed by the Calabrians themselves. This was the more remarkable, seeing that the country was still occupied by the Neapolitan troops, and that for the 10 days preceding Garibaldi's crossing, Missouri was being hunted like a partridge in the mountains. On August 15th, General Ruiz, with 2 battalions, was sent up after him from the coast, and pursued him in vain through the forest gorges, of which the fantastic magnificence had more than once attracted landscape painters like Sir Arthur Strutt and Edward Lear to brave very real dangers of brigandage. The Garibaldini escaped over the upper plains of Aspromonte, many miles across, where only a few huts and sheepfolds broke the monotony of the desert, and where the only point visible on the horizon was Etna's purple cone. "It was impossible," wrote Alberto Mario, as he tramped behind Missouri through such scenes, "even in the hazardous project which absorbed us, not to be at times subdued by a mighty awe." After this first failure, Garibaldi was only the more anxious to cross the straits. The call of the peoples for his presence among them, of which he had spoken in his letter to Victor Emmanuel, was growing daily more insistent. Half Calabria, in anticipation of his coming, was already in open revolt. The liberty of the press, the sympathies of the new constitutional magistracy and police, made rebellion easy in any town or village not actually occupied by the regular troops, and the lower clergy, in contrast to the bishops, often took the popular side. In the toe of Italy, the presence of 16,000 troops prevented the insurrection from breaking out along the thickly populated coastline, and confined the movement to the wanderings of Missouri's bands in the heights of Aspromonte. But the province of Cosenza, in Upper Calabria, fell more or less into the hands of revolutionary committees in the first days of August, and the Basilicata followed suit on August 18th. The movement in Calabria had been stirred up by the great local proprietors, the Plutino family, Stocco of the Thousand, and Pace of Medici's expedition, whom Garibaldi had sent on to their old homes to prepare the way for him. In the Basilicata, a like part was played by Mignona, also commissioned by Garibaldi. The leaders of the insurrection in the provinces south of the capital showed both sense and courage, and succeeded in overawing the troops in their midst, such as the formidable garrison of Cosenza, who remained passive spectators of the rebellion. If the northern provinces had been equally liberal, and the inhabitants of Naples equally bold, Cavour would have got his revolution without need of further help from Garibaldi. As the moment for invading the mainland drew near, the recently enlisted Sicilian bands, considering their part in the affair completed, began to desert in hundreds from Messina and the Faro. Many of them had fought well for the deliverance of their own island, but few shared the enthusiasm of their northern liberators for the idea of Italian unity, insofar as it meant protection by Piedmont against the return of the detested Neapolitans. Italian unity was good, but insofar as it meant friendly dealings with the Neapolitans, it was not. Now that their own island was safe, they returned to their homes. Only Dunne's regiment of 600 and a Sicilian brigade of 800 Cacciatori d'Etna, led by real enthusiasts like La Massa, Corrao, and La Porta, of whom the last two were good soldiers, shared the fortunes of the army until the end of the Volturno campaign. If the dictator had any doubts as to the real wishes of the court of Turin, they were removed by another secret message which reached him at the Faro through the hands of Victor Emmanuel's aide-de-camp Trecci, the regular medium of royal communication with Garibaldi. The king's positive orders to the dictator were to occupy Naples, and thence to invade the Pope's territory of Umbria and the Marches. It's not easy to judge whether or not Cavour was a party to this message. On the one hand, it was a habit of Victor Emmanuel to carry on a policy of his own through secret agents acting behind the back of his ministers. And certainly Cavour was on principle opposed to a red-shirt invasion of the Papal States. He wished to keep the liberation of the Marches and Umbria as a royal prerogative, and not to allow it to become a new source of strength to the advanced parties, who, he feared, would then dictate terms to the monarchy and attack the city of Rome at the risk of war with France. On the other hand, the king's message, though in apparent contradiction to Cavour's policy, was perhaps one of the subtlest moves in the minister's game. In order to interpret the royal words of encouragement to Garibaldi, dictated on August 5th, it is necessary to understand that Cavour had already, 4 days earlier, determined in his own mind to invade the Papal States from the north with the regular army of Piedmont. On August 1st, he had written to Nigra in Paris and to Emmanuel de Azeglio in London, disclosing to them this secret, the key to all his subsequent policy and ultra-confidential letters which were to be destroyed as soon as read. The grounds on which he adopted this decision, the greatest and boldest of his whole life, will be discussed in a future chapter. The policy did not take effect until September, and till then was not foreseen by the world at large. It is therefore enough at this stage to point out that by August 1st, Cavour had secretly determined to invade the Papal States himself. He had therefore the less objection to the further advance of Garibaldi, because now he knew that the king would be able at once to assist and to control the red shirts by meeting them with the regular army either at Naples or on the southern border of the Papal States. He was not yet prepared to disclose this plan to Garibaldi, but he was perhaps not sorry that the king should keep the dictator in good humor by talking about a Garibaldian invasion of the Papal States from Naples, which would now never really take place, since the royal troops would forestall him in the Pope's territories. It was the more necessary to tell Garibaldi that he might invade the Papal States from Naples, because Cavour was at this moment putting his veto on Mancini's plan to invade the Papal States direct from Genoa with Bertani's private army. Bertani's committee, in aid of Garibaldi, had not yet sent out to him any large body of men. Throughout June and July, the expeditions dispatched to Sicily had been organized chiefly by the moderates and by the supporters of Cavour. Although Bertani had been levying and equipping volunteers ever since Garibaldi sailed in May, he had hitherto held them in reserve for a blow at the Papal States. Garibaldi had all along favored such a design, while at the same time demanding reinforcements for himself in Sicily. On July 30th, he wrote from the Faro to Bertani, "As to the operations in the Papal and Neapolitan territories, push them on with all possible vigor." The time had now come to strike the blow. In the first days of August, Bertani had at his disposal 8,940 volunteers, who, unlike the men of the earlier expeditions, were ready armed, uniformed, and organized for immediate service in the field. 6,000 of them were at Genoa, but some were at Florence under Nicotera, and a few more in the Romagna. The detachments at Florence and in the Romagna were to invade Umbria and the Marches respectively, while the main body were to sail from Genoa, land in the Papal territories at a point north of Civita Vecchia, and march by way of Viterbo to join Nicotera and the others in the east. Rome and Civita Vecchia, the only places occupied by French garrisons, were to be spared for the present. There were grave objections to this plan. First, Lamoriciere's newly levied army of Papal crusaders, being superior in numbers and not wholly inferior in enthusiasm to Bertani's volunteers, could not be destroyed with the rapidity which was essential if French and Austrian interference was to be forestalled. 9,000 Italian volunteers, under the command of Pianciani, whom Mazzini and Bertani had chosen for his politics rather than for his military capacity, would not be worth half the number under Garibaldi. Further, Garibaldi was beginning to find, as August advanced and the Sicilians dispersed to their homes, that he could not cross the straits in the face of the Neapolitan armies on the Calabrian shore until he received strong reinforcements from the north. On August 11th, he was expecting shortly to be joined at the Straits by volunteers whom Bertani had organized at Genoa, but Piancianni was preparing to lead them off to a wholly different part of the Italian peninsula, under the delusion that Garibaldi would have 6,000 Sicilian soldiers to take with him across the Straits, in addition to his northern followers. Cavour, however, prevented this fatal mistake from being made. He could not allow revolutionary armies, organized by Mancini and Bertani, to start from Genoa direct for the Papal States. An invasion made under such conditions must inevitably provoke French interference. He therefore sent to Genoa his principal colleague Farini to negotiate with Bertani about the destination of Piancianni's force. Saffi, ex-triumvir of Rome, was present at the interview. Farini told Bertani that the king's government intended itself to invade the Papal States. "Before many days," he said, "our own bugles will be sounding." In any case, the time was not quite ripe, and therefore the government must insist that Piancianni and his volunteers should sail first to the Golfo del Ghiaranchi in Sardinia, and thence to Sicily, where they would necessarily become subject to Garibaldi's orders. After touching at Sicily, they might go to whatever part their leaders wished, not excluding the Papal States, provided that they did not re-enter Piedmontese territory as a base from which to attack the Pope. This compromise was agreed upon by Farini for the government and by Bertani for the volunteers. The clear intention of the authorities to use force rather than permit the invasion of the Papal States direct from the port of Genoa had compelled Bertani to temporize. But he had no real thought of fulfilling his part of the bargain by sending Piancianni's men to Sicily. The government had promised to let his volunteers sail for the Golfo degli Aranci, stealing away from the camp beside the straits so secretly that no one knew whither he had gone nor why. But all felt that great events were in the air, and that when they next saw him there would be an end to this wearisome delay. It is hard to know what were Garibaldi's intentions on board the Washington, as it carried him and Bertani on their hazardous voyage to Sardinia through the midst of the Neapolitan cruisers. Bertani was under the erroneous belief that the general would consent to lead the volunteers straight from the Golfo degli Aranci to the Papal States. But until the moment of Bertani's arrival at the Faro, Garibaldi had intended to use the greater number of them to assist his passage of the Straits of Messina, and he himself tells us that he rejected Bertani's proposal to go to the Papal States, and was considering instead whether he might not attempt a direct coup de main on Naples. But the vigilance of the Piedmontese government had settled the matter beforehand. When at dawn of August 14th, the Washington, bearing Garibaldi and Bertani, steamed into the Golfo degli Aranci, only one part of the fleet that had transported the volunteers from Genoa was to be found in the bay. The rest had already been compelled by Piedmontese warships to go on to Sicily, in accordance with the agreement which Bertani had made with the government, and was now plotting to evade. He was wild with fury when he saw that he had been frustrated. Garibaldi, on the other hand, fell back without any serious loss of temper on the plan which he had entertained 3 days before of using Piancianni's men to force the passage of the Straits of Messina. Since he had chanced to come so near to his island home of Caprera, he went to pass a few hours there in repose. With the poignant affection and delight of a boy at home on his day's exeat in the middle of term, the dictator wandered amid the sweet-smelling shrubs and the chaos of granite rocks, called his favorite cows up to him by name, and fed them from his hand. Then he took ship again for Palermo, where all Piancianni's expedition was soon assembled, 6,000 strong. Even at Palermo, Bertani again implored him to lead the men to the Papal States, but his mind was now once more intent on the problem of the Straits of Messina. Piancianni therefore resigned his commission and went home, but Bertani remained at the seat of war, hoping to use his influence upon Garibaldi in opposition to the more moderate counsels of the soldiers, Medici, Tours, Bixio, and Cosenz, who were all well aware of the necessity of avoiding a breach with Cavour, there still remained some 2,000 volunteers in Tuscany under Nicotera, who had not been specifically mentioned in the terms of the agreement between Bertani and Farini at Genoa. Garibaldi, though requiring Pianciani's men in order to effect the passage of the Straits, was still willing that Nicotera should invade the Pope's territory by land, and wrote him to that effect. But Cavour instructed Ricasoli, as governor of Tuscany, not to permit any such movement. After an embittered quarrel, in which Ricasoli and Nicotera behaved each with small consideration for the other, the governor had his way, and the last of the volunteers were forcibly shipped to Sicily. Thus the whole army which Bertani had prepared against the Pope, more than 8,000 in number, finally swelled Garibaldi's force in the south, and was of indispensable service to him in his occupation and subsequent defense of Naples. They were almost the last volunteers who joined him from North Italy, for Cavour, alarmed by the constant threat of the advanced parties to invade the papal territory, and now fully determined to invade it himself, prohibited on August 13th the further levy or dispatch of volunteers under any pretext, and this time, to the surprise of diplomatic Europe, actually enforced his proclamation. There were no more departures en masse from Genoa, though some hundreds of private individuals went south with government passports. In all, Garibaldi had about 20,000 northerners under him in the course of the year, and at the Straits he already had, at that time of his crossing, much the greater part of this total, besides Sicilians. He was a match, even in numbers, for the troops in the tow of Italy, provided his transports could escape the enemy's fleet. But by all ordinary calculation, that was impossible. End of Chapter 5, Part 2. Chapter 6 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Crossing of the Straits. Ci volte, signore, e sono un vecchio soldato. E perciò mi attendeva che Garibaldi attaccasse di fronte, ed invece mi capitato alle spalle. What do you expect, gentlemen? I am an old soldier, and so, of course, I expected Garibaldi to attack me in front, and he came from behind instead. General Galotti's explanation of his defeat overheard by Arrivabene. Lo coraggio è un dono di Dio, ed io non l'ho. Courage is a gift of God, and I have it not. Saying attributed to a Neapolitan soldier by the Garibaldini. Between the working of one great action and the next, Nino Bixio was heard of chiefly through his deeds of insane violence. After the taking of Palermo, the second of the thousand had distinguished himself in the Sicilian capital by his quarrel with a brother-in-arms, the self-sacrificing Agneta, whom he struck in the face for an imaginary insult. Since Garibaldi would allow no duel on campaign, they did not fight it out until late the following year in Switzerland. Bixio came tardily and unwillingly on to the field of honor, because he of all men had scruples against dueling. Agneta shot him in the hand, crippling it for the rest of his life, whereupon Bixio said, "I'm punished in the hand that gave the offense." He subsequently earned Agneta's gratitude by services of real friendship. Bixio was not present at the Battle of Milazzo, for he was leading his command through the south of the island. When at the end of July all the Garibaldian columns met near the Straits, he was sent by the dictator to suppress a predatory and murderous anarchist rising under the western slopes of Etna. There at Randazzo and on Nelson's old estate of Bronte, his summary methods and manners soon terrified the wrongdoers into submission at the cost of only a few actual executions. Bixio's own soldiers were always complaining of him. "He's mad. He is intolerable." "Very well. Under whom do you wish to serve, then?" "What? Eh?" "Oh, under Bixio, of course."
At Bronte one morning some volunteers recently arrived from North Italy, and not accustomed to his ways, were late in turning out of bed. He went into the houses after them with a horsewhip. The older troops, who had marched under him and learnt to love him, with difficulty saved his life from the fury of the new men, who had come out to fight under Garibaldi, not to be whipped in like hounds. But now an action was in hand, on which his rage to be up and doing for his country could be spent to better purpose. The dictator had been away in Sardinia and Palermo for nearly 6 days, and no one at the Straits knew when or whether he would return. The suspense on both shores was terrible. On the morning of August 18th, he suddenly reappeared in the Faro camp, gave his orders, left for Messina, and an hour afterwards was seen driving through its streets in a three-horse carriage along the southern road. His movements were still as mysterious as ever, for he was again travelling away from the scene of active operations at the Faro. But in fact, the camp and flotilla beneath the lighthouse were to serve during the next 24 hours only as a decoy to fix the attention of the enemy's ships and regiments on the narrow waters of Scilla and Charybdis, while the rest of the crossing took place at the border part of the Straits, 30 miles to the south. On the afternoon of August 18th, Garibaldi's carriage reached the hamlet of Giardini, which stretches along the beach between the wall of mountains and the sea, at the southern foot of Taormina Rock. Here Bixio's men from Bronte and Catania had been secretly collected during the last 2 days. Here the Torino and the Franklin had safely arrived, after steaming around the whole island from the Faro, in order to avoid the Neapolitan cruisers in the Straits. The captain of the Torino, a man of peace, who objected to the use of his transport vessel for an enterprise so hazardous as an attack on the Calabrian coast, had been silenced and placed under arrest by Bixio. The troops, 3,360 in number, were already on board the two steamers when Garibaldi drove up. When all was ready, it was found that the Franklin had sprung a leak. The hole could not be found, and Bixio proposed that they should start with the Torino alone. But when Garibaldi took the matter in hand, the hole was soon found and stopped. To judge by the space which he allots to his operation in his memoirs, the dictator recalled it with more interest than all his historic achievements during the next fortnight. That he should cause 15,000 soldiers of tyranny to lay down their arms seemed to him no more than an inevitable fate, now that Italy's hour had struck. But to find and caulk a hole in a ship which had baffled the other seamen was an action of which a man had good right to be proud. At nightfall the two vessels steamed out from below the rock of Taormina. The distance to Melito, the point chosen for the landing in Calabria, is 30 miles, and if at any point in the crossing the unarmed transports had fallen in with the Neapolitan warship, they could have been sunk to the bottom. But the enemy were all away at the Narrows, watching the camp and flotilla at the Faro. The night voyage was unbroken by anything more terrifying than the voice of Bixio from the Torino, continually shouting through his megaphone to the silent Garibaldi in the Franklin. When dawn revealed Etna's cone and the long ranges of subject Sicilian mountains at her feet, the Calabrian coast lay close ahead. Again, as at Marsala, Bixio ran his vessel aground on the shallows, but the men of both the steamers were taken off in the ship's boats and landed on the desolate beach called Porto Salvo, a mile from Melito village. There were no houses near, but an old chapel with a cupola rose amid the cactuses and aloes at the edge of the sea-sand. The flat country behind, though it bore olive groves and scraps of cultivation, was arid for the most part, stripped and scarred each winter by the torrents from Aspromonte. The mountains themselves here stand back a mile or two from the coast. But the Garibaldini, as they landed, saw the pillar rock of Pendendatilo raising its five grotesque fingers against the dawn. Garibaldi spent the whole morning on the 19th in a vain attempt to salvage the Torino. He was waiting also for Missouri's men to come down from the mountains near San Lorenzo,
whither he had sent them a message to announce his landing. In the afternoon, Neapolitan war vessels appeared from the direction of Messina, destroyed the grounded and derelict Torino, and fired, not without some effect, into the red shirts on shore. The Franklin had returned safely to Sicily. Towards evening, the vanguard of Missouri's men appeared on the neighboring mountains, and the night of August 19th and 20th was spent in bivouac, not far from Melito. For 36 hours many of the troops had neither food nor drink. Some of them, who were inland bred, dug holes in the seashore and lapped the water that oozed up, in desperate hope that Neptune would lose his salt by filtering through the sand. On August 19th, the telegraphs and semaphores in the Neapolitan kingdom had been wagging all day with ominous rumors from the south, and before midnight the ministers at Naples knew that there had been a landing in force a dozen miles beyond Reggio. There were now some 16,000 royalist troops in Lower Calabria. General Vial, their commander-in-chief, had his headquarters in Monteleone, too far removed from the scene of operations. His regiments were scattered along 50 miles of road between Monteleone and Reggio. His lieutenants, Melendez and Briganti, were guarding the supposed points of danger opposite the Faro, but at the moment of Garibaldi's landing there were no troops south of Reggio, and in Reggio itself only some 1,000 men, chiefly of the 14th line. When 48 hours later Garibaldi fell upon the city, the numbers of its garrison had not been increased by a single man. The news of the landing at Melito ought to have caused an instantaneous move in that direction on the part of each of the columns scattered along the coast road. But neither Vial, Melendez, nor Briganti stirred until it was too late to save Reggio, in spite of a stream of indignant telegrams from Pianell at Naples. The war minister had been anxious to avoid fighting in Sicily, and had, perhaps, not sent enough troops to guard the straits. But his telegrams show that he did his best to make the generals fight Garibaldi when once he had landed. When old General Galotti, in command at Reggio, was the most complete dotard of them all, when informed of the landing at Melito, he said that Garibaldi had taken to the mountains, and that Reggio could not be attacked from that side, but only in front from the sea. Therefore he made no preparations to defend the city. He forbade the energetic Colonel Dusme to take up a good position near the castle, and compelled him instead to bivouac in the middle of the cathedral square, a mere trap for those who occupied it, unless the entrances to the city were strongly guarded. These, however, were confided to the National Guard of liberal bourgeoisie, whose loyalty was more than doubtful. Galotti himself remained in the castle with the garrison. The castle of Reggio is a tall, grim building, flanked by round towers somewhat similar in strength and appearance to the Bastille of old Paris, though on a smaller scale. But unlike the Bastille, it does not rise clear above all possible assailants, for Reggio is built on the side of a hill, and since the castle is only halfway up the hill, its battlements can be commanded by sharpshooters at the top of the town. On the 20th, the invaders marched from Melito, passing over the top of the sandstone cliff of Capo dell'Arme Lucopetra, whose white rock had been a famous sea mark to the sailors of the ancient world. The general walked with his saber over his shoulder, talking and singing with the men. All were hungry but in high spirits. Near Reggio they rested again, and at midnight advanced to the attack. Garibaldi, with Missouri's men, entered the upper town by way of the hills, through Spirito Santo. Bixio, with the main column, kept the high road through Spare, and came in by the principal streets below the castle. His men stumbled upon outposts at the entrance of the city. Ci va là, Garibaldi! Avanti! It was the National Guard standing aside to let them pass. They hurried on through the sleeping streets. In the middle of the town they came upon other sentries. Ci va là, Garibaldi! Bang! They had come upon the loyal troops at last. A fierce struggle raged in the great cathedral square until morning. Colonel Dusme and his son, not yet of age,
fell gallantly fighting in front of the royalists. Bixio's horses received 19 wounds, and their rider 2 in the arm, to which he paid no attention till Garibaldi sent him to bed the next night, saying, "I suppose the balls that reach you are made of puff paste." The odds were all against the 14th line, and Garibaldi's column was pouring in upon their rear from the upper town. As day broke, the red shirts possessed themselves of all Reggio except the castle, which was provisioned for a month and could easily be defended against its present assailants. Later in the same day, August 21st, Briganti approached Reggio from Villa San Giovanni with about 2,000 men. Garibaldi led his troops out into the country just beyond the northern suburbs and took up a position to cover the town. After the exchange of a few shots in a feeble reconnaissance, Briganti fell back, leaving Reggio to its fate. Garibaldi afterwards wrote that if the attack had been pressed, the royalists might have very possibly, with the help of the garrison in the castle, have recovered the town, and in that case his own position would have been desperate. Indeed, the troops in the castle had clamored to be let out to attack him in the rear and join hands with the relieving force, but Galotti had refused to allow a sally. Hitherto the royalist garrison in Reggio, with the exception of Galotti himself, had behaved well, but after Briganti's retreat they felt themselves deserted and began to lose courage. When sharpshooters placed by Garibaldi on the upper part of the town commenced picking off the men on the battlements, panic set in, and the castle, which might have held out for weeks, was surrendered within 24 hours. The taking of Reggio had cost the victors about 150 in killed and wounded. On the same day, another important event took place to the north of the straits. Garibaldi had left Cosenz in command at the Faro, with instructions that he was to carry his troops across the water, at the moment when the dictator himself attacked Reggio. There was a good chance that Cosenz would be able to cross in safety, because the Neapolitan war vessels had now, too late, left the narrow waters and gone south to attend to Garibaldi after his landing at Melito. Before sunrise on August 21st, to the sound of the distant firing from Reggio, the flotilla of rowboats put out from Faro, carrying between 1,000 and 1,500 volunteers. They struggled successfully against the currents of Charybdis, made a wide detour to avoid the cannonballs from the fort of Scylla, and landed the same morning on the strip of flat shore beneath the wall of wooded mountains at Favazzina. The Neapolitan warships, hastily summoned back from Reggio, sank and captured a large number of boats as the fishermen were taking them back empty to the Faro. A few minutes after Cosenz and his men had landed at Favazzina, they were attacked while crossing the coast road by Neapolitan troops from Scylla on one side and Bagnara on the other. The enemy were repulsed chiefly by the Genoese carabineers, the pick of Garibaldi's original 1,000, and the whole force proceeded straight up the sides of Aspromonte by precipitous attacks through the brushwood. At noontide the greater part had reached the hamlet of Solano, 2,000 feet above the sea. Overcome by heat, thirst, and fatigue, they took their siesta in the houses, believing that all the royalists' forces were far below them on the level of the shore. From the precipice edge of Solano they looked back down the gulf of an enormous ravine below, but the village itself, closely overshadowed by other heights, covered with chestnut woods, and in these a few hundred Neapolitan troops were lying concealed. They were a detachment of Ruiz's men, who had not yet gone down off Aspromonte from their vain pursuit of Missouri's column. Though inferior in numbers to Cosenz, the royalists seized their advantage, surprised the sentinels, and burst into the village. The Garibaldini had an hour's hard fighting before they could drive them out. Two little companies of French and English volunteers distinguished themselves in the scuffle, under the leadership of De Flotte and of Goodall. De Flotte was killed in the street at the head of his men. He was a French Republican exile who had played a part in Paris in 48, and narrowly escaped Cayenne after Napoleon III's coup d'etat.
He had been loved by all his companions in arms, English, Italians, and French, and Garibaldi, when he heard of his death, mourned for him as a true soldier of liberty. They buried him where he fell, high up among the granite gorges and the chestnut woods, far from his fierce gay city and the boulevard lights. After repulsing this attack, Cosenz's column mounted another 1,500 feet to Forestale on the higher plains of Aspromonte. There they received a message from the dictator bidding them march westward and join him above Villa San Giovanni. Their sufferings on the plateaus of Aspromonte were severe. Starved and sunbaked all day, at night they were soaked with the dew and chilled with the intense cold of the mountain, so that Goodall and other useful soldiers were put out of action. The movements of Garibaldi and Cosenz are a model of combined action from two separate bases. Each had enabled the other to succeed by distracting the attention of the enemy's naval and military force, and now they were about to join hands at a spot above and in rear of the enemy's main line of defense. On August 22nd, the morning after the fall of Reggio, the dictator and Bixio moved northward to attack the forts and regiments commanding the narrowest part of the straits. Again Bixio kept the coast road and Garibaldi the hills. On the evening of that day, the dictator joined forces with Cosenz above Piale and Villa San Giovanni. After this junction, he had with him about 5,000 men, and was for a while superior to the enemy both in numbers and position. Down below, between him and the sea, lie rather more than 3,000 troops under General Melendez and Briganti. The greater part of this force was in Villa San Giovanni, on the coast road, under the command of Briganti. But Melendez, with 1,200 men, occupied Piale village, a mile up the hillside. Garibaldi was above them both at Campo Calabrese, where Murat had pitched his tents when he threatened Sicily with invasion. These seaward heights, now occupied by the red shirts, bore no resemblance to the wooded and precipitous mountains below which Cosenz had landed. It is a tumbled-down land of broken mud banks on which vineyards, fruit gardens, cactuses, and houses maintain an ever-precarious existence. The landscape on this part of the Calabrian shore is more weird than beautiful, but the view thence of the straits, of Sicily and of Etna, Mongibello, the fair mountain as the Calabrians call it, filled the Garibaldini with delight as they waited for the surrender of their foes. An artillery duel between the Neapolitan ships and the batteries at the Faro was watched by both armies as from the seats of a theatre, of which the lower circles were occupied by the royalists. On the 22nd, Melendez and Briganti might still have retreated to Scilla, for it was only during the following night that the dictator cut off their retreat by pushing his advanced guard down to the coast at Canitello. But they let the hour slip by in the vain expectation of reinforcements from the north. Besides the men whom they had with them, there were more than 10,000 royalist troops in Lower Calabria, and they naturally supposed that Vial would lead these to their rescue. But the commander-in-chief had no advantage except in point of age over his dotard lieutenants. A pleasure-loving and idle young man, raised by personal influences at court to a command for which he had no qualifications, Vial had too much of the heartless flippancy of the Neapolitan to be serious over even the gravest situation. He continued to linger and amuse himself at Monteleone, saying that he would give Joe a ducking if he tried to cross the straits. When he heard that Joe had crossed and was taking Reggio, he still lingered with the greater part of the troops under his command 50 miles from the scene of action. At length, driven to the front by furious telegrams from Pianell, the war minister, he sailed from Pizzo on the morning of August 22nd, taking with him one of his best battalions. He landed alone at Villa San Giovanni, interviewed Briganti and Melendez, and ordered them to hold out while he set this battalion ashore at Scilla and led it to their rescue. He then returned to Scilla, but as a sea had risen, which made the landing of troops momentarily difficult, he hailed the excuse to sail back with the battalion to Pizzo and Monteleone, leaving his lieutenants to their fate without even warning them that he had changed his plan and run away. Meanwhile, Melendez and Briganti were expecting aid not only from Vial but from General Ruiz, who had at length descended from Aspromonte to the coast road and was hurrying along it to their rescue. Like Vial, Ruiz came on alone in front of his column to take stock of the situation. He visited Melendez and Briganti up at Piale and then went down to the main road again to bring up his column from Altafumara. But on his way back through Villa San Giovanni, he could not fail to observe that Briganti's men were in a state of complete demoralization. Red Shirts were going about among them with impunity in cafes and at street corners, exhorting them not to prolong a useless and fratricidal contest, and it was only too evident that the men were listening. There was little of active disloyalty or of political liberalism among the rank and file, but they had in August small motive or encouragement to fight. They were at once terrified and fascinated by the name of Garibaldi, and after the taking of Reggio regarded him as unconquerable. During the last 2 months, ever since the grant of the Constitution, they had been forced to march under the tricolored flag, the flag, as it seemed to them, of their enemies. They witnessed in every street down which they passed the enthusiasm of the populace for the revolution and the open disloyalty of the new civic authorities, who proclaimed "Long live the King!" as a seditious cry. Their own officers were visibly shaking with fear, muttering their doubts to each other, or preoccupied with private thoughts of which the character was only too evident. Their general, Briganti, was known to be in favor of negotiation. The enemy, it appeared, was to be regarded as more than half a friend, since no one prevented his emissaries from entering their lines to talk sedition in the open street of Villa San Giovanni. As Ruiz rode through the town, noting what he saw, he judged that Briganti and his troops did not mean to fight, and that he had best save his own men from sharing in their surrender. A few miles further north, at Altifumara, he met his column hastening up, ordered it to turn right about, and before nightfall on the 22nd had led it back to Bagnara. Like Vial, Ruiz was pursued by indignant telegrams from the war minister at Naples, to the effect that Melendez and Briganti were preparing to die at their posts, while he basely deserted them. But he knew better, and rather than face Garibaldi again, he resigned his command. His successor, Morisani, on the morning of the 23rd, began to march back once more to the relief of San Giovanni, but was met and turned back for good, and all by a messenger from Melendez himself, who declared that it was now too late. In this fashion, Melendez and Briganti, lured by false hopes that Vial and Ruiz were marching to their relief, had let slip the opportunity to escape out of their untenable positions on August 22nd. At daybreak on the 23rd, they saw that retreat was no longer possible. During the night, Garibaldi had drawn the net around them by sending down detachments from Camp Calabrese to Canitello. They were completely surrounded, with a semicircle of sea on one side and a semicircle of red shirts on the other. As the sun rose, the Garibaldini began to descend upon them from the hills. The Neapolitan rifles and cannon opened fire, but the advancing host made no reply. The slow, ordered, noiseless approach of their enemies affected the nerves of the royalists, as Garibaldi had intended that it should. They opened negotiations. A Garibaldian parlementaire with the white flag in his hand was shot dead, but General Briganti himself came out to apologize. He explained to the dictator that he would have been a liberal himself, but he had two sons in the Neapolitan army, and so felt gratitude to the Bourbons. "Otherwise," he said, "I would join you." He asked to surrender with the honors of war. Garibaldi gave him and Melendez till 3 o'clock to surrender unconditionally, and allowed them to send out a messenger who, as already related, stopped the further advance of Morisani to their rescue. Meanwhile, the Garibaldian army halted on the hillside and watched the confusion growing hour by hour among their enemies below. When the appointed time had run out, the advance was resumed. As the red shirts drew the circle close upon them, the royalists threw away their arms and knapsacks and fled in a mob along the northern road. They were turned back by a volley and crowded together like driven sheep in the center of their position. Garibaldi rode almost alone into their midst. "Soldiers," he said, "you as well as my companions are the sons of Italy. Remember that. You are at liberty. Whoever wishes to remain with us may address himself to General Cosenz, your countryman, who is charged to enlist you. But whoever wishes may go home." At these words they rushed at him with cries of joy, and much to his disgust began kissing his hands, arms, and feet. 3,500 men, 4 field pieces, and the fort of Punto di Pezzo, with its artillery, were the prize of this bloodless victory. Very few of the men chose to enlist under Cosenz, but as they scattered to their homes, they spread the news that Garibaldi's custom was to send off his prisoners free. And this knowledge greatly increased the readiness of the troops under Vial and Ruiz to follow the example set at Villa San Giovanni. That example proved contagious along the whole road to Naples. The next day, August 24th, the fort of Altifiumara, which had resisted Missori's attack a fortnight before, the neighboring fort of Torre Cavallo, and the more formidable castle on the rock of Scilla, armed with 22 cannon, all opened their gates to the outriders of the invading army, among whom Garibaldi himself was one of the foremost. As soon as the batteries of these forts had compelled the Neapolitan navy to sail out of the straits, Medici's regiments at Messina were brought safely across to the mainland. The race to Naples had now fairly begun. It was led by Garibaldi and his staff, many hours ahead of the van of their army, accompanied by Jesse and Alberto Mario, and by some English gentlemen who liked fatigue and had the luck and money to hire horses that could keep the pace. There were more than 10,000 of the enemy close ahead, but no one feared that they would resist when overtaken. Basilicata and Upper Calabria were already rising in arms. The dictator and his companions set out to ride unchallenged along the great trunk road that stretches for 250 miles through mountains and forests and fever-stricken plains from the foot of Aspromonte to the foot of Vesuvius. End of chapter 6.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.